and is produced by Dennis Bernstein, with associate producer Leslie Kane and contributing producer Robert Knight. Our technical director is Mary Bishop, with assistance provided by Ranjita Giesler. We had production assistance from Stephanie Hendricks and from Eric Park. Our intern is Nora Barrows-Friedman. For a taped copy of this broadcast, call 510-848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to John Lionheart, our web maestro, and thank you for listening.
This is KPFT at 90.1 FM in Houston. Coming up next, Queer Voices.
Hello and welcome to the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief. In football news, Major League Soccer begins its eighth season of operation. With that, I spoke with Trey Fitzgerald, spokesman for Major League Soccer, about the upcoming 2003 season and hopefully expansion into Houston.
It's pretty amazing to think that a year ago at this time, we were coming out of the very difficult process of contraction with the by getting rid of the two Florida teams. This year now, we have the most momentum we've ever had. Well, things are as positive across the board, looking at the stability. We're talking expansion. We're talking with new owners. Our attendance is up. Our corporate sponsorship interest is excellent in a very difficult economy. Our mainstream and soccer media coverage is consistent and growing, and we're very pleased. It's just a lot of signs of maturity for the league as we go into our eighth season. We feel like we finally have a solid foundation beneath us, and we can concentrate on tweaking and doing things better, continuing to grow. So everybody's very positive. There's still a lot of work, but we've got that stadium opening in L.A., on June 7th. We've got recently the voters in the city of Frisco and in Cullen County outside of Dallas, they're giving us $55 million of public money to build a soccer complex for the Dallas Burn and for all the youth players there. So there's so many great things happening, and it takes time and it takes patience and it takes hard work, but we feel very good about where we are and where we're going.
On expansion into Houston, Trey said,
6 months we'll know what the two expansion teams are going to be, two expansion cities are going to be for 2005, and I know everybody down in Houston hopes that they are one of them. It just, we've got to get our duck in a row, and you need an ownership group, you need a stadium, you need a season ticket commitment, and you need corporate sponsor involvement. But everybody that we've talked to surrounding this game, the U.S. Mexico game on May 8th, and everybody we've talked to about bringing Major League Soccer to Houston is very positive. There's a great spirit of cooperation and trying to figure out how to make the deal happen so that it works out well for everybody. So we're optimistic that we will be in good shape.
That was Trey Fitzgerald of Major League Soccer, and this has been Richard Hanna with the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
We have a lot going on our show tonight because it's beginning to be that season where a lot of things go on because the weather's so beautiful out there and a lot of things go on outside. But that's what we're going to be talking about tonight.
I was wondering.
Well, we will be talking to Anise Parker, who is going to be here talking about her last year as city council person at large position one for the city of Houston. And she's going to be running for city controller. Then we're going to be, unfortunately, have some not-so-good talks with both Sauna Elton with the Montrose Clinic and Sally Huffer with the Montrose Counseling Center, where both of those organizations are having their fundings cut by a lot.
Yes, drastically reduced funding on both counts.
Yes, so excellent article in the Triangle on that.
That Joan wrote.
Well, yes.
Then we will be talking to David Muck from the Human Rights Campaign.
That's right. He'll be talking to us about what the HRC is calling kitchen table topics.
And in the last part of our show, of our live segments here, we'll be talking to Robert Allen, who is going to be discussing the Body Electric School, which is an erotic class that's going to be happening in May here in Houston.
Ooh, baby.
And besides that, we're going to be having a bunch of our stuff from This Way Out. But first up, we're going to talk to Randall Ellis, who is executive director of Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby. And I almost wish this could be a comedy piece, but the unfortunate thing, it's not as funny as all this stuff seems, because what's going on in the legislature right now is rather scary. What's going on, Randall?
Well, you're right. It is a very scary time for the LGBT community in Texas. Tonight is the eve before a hearing in State Affairs Committee, the hearing on a bill, HB 1911, that would prevent the placement of a child in a foster home with any unmarried adult living in that foster home. Now, Mr. Talton's intention with this bill is to restrict the ability of gays and lesbians to serve as foster parents in the state of Texas.
Well, not only gays and lesbians, but anybody who isn't married.
Exactly. You know, he filed a bill back in November, the first opportunity he had, that specifically would rule out gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. And he expanded his circle of intolerance with this second bill, HB 1911, as language says, any unmarried adult living in the household disqualified that household as serving as a foster home. And we know well, that committee knows all too well that gays and lesbians can't get married in the state of Texas, and therefore we will be unmarried adults.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, that's just going to cost more money to the state that doesn't have any money.
Exactly. You know, I worked for Representative Garnett Coleman before I took this job and worked on the appropriations. So I know the difficulty that the state is facing with its budget, the huge holes in it this session. And they're kicking the elderly and children off health insurance and out of homes just to balance the budget. This bill has not even included in any of their budgetary estimates. So we have estimates that place it at about $16 million a year if you look at restricting foster care and adoption. This one, there is actually an agency that does a fiscal impact. They've estimated about $8 million a year, this HB 1911 alone.
Well, and that's really interesting. You're talking about cutting health care, and the fact is that some of the money that goes for health care is matching funds with the federal government, which means like every dollar cut from the state is like $2 cut from the federal government, which means $3 is being cut.
Exactly.
Something
like
that.
You see this issue, it comes up in foster care, we lose federal funds. We saw it last week on the budget debate, you know, by cutting on the Medicaid program, we don't pay state money, we lose federal money, but then the counties are forced to pay this bill in the end.
Right, at higher cost for hospitals.
Exactly. I mean, and then the county ends up, or the hospital district ends up paying these bills with 100% of tax revenue, local tax revenue, nothing from the federal government, as if it were done through the Medicaid program. Go ahead.
How did we all of a sudden find out that we were $10 billion in debt? And I know Texas isn't the only state, and not only states, but cities and counties are going through a lot of this, too.
Yeah. You know, it was something, you know, we passed the budget. We had a surplus last session, and it was a very small surplus, but we passed a balanced budget that everyone seemed to be happy with. But as the economy ticked down, we have less tax revenue. And at the same time, when you see a dip in the economy, you see more people in need of those health and human services, such as Medicaid or foster care. The need for those things go up. So it puts us in a very difficult situation here in Austin and a very difficult situation for the members of the legislature writing the budget.
And Jack, I should mention that there's a really good article in the New York Times today that goes on for 4 pages explaining how this has impacted states all over the country and exactly why.
Okay. Great.
You know, and it's a difficult thing because Texas ranks, you know, if it's not number 50, it's number 48 or 49 in these health and human service areas.
And, right, and it's usually thank God for Mississippi.
Exactly. I've said that more than once.
Yeah, well, it's sort of unfortunate, though. So what do we do?
Well, you know, what the LGRL is concentrating on right now is House Bill 1911, a bill that would restrict foster care to the LGBT community and the unmarried adult. We need to become involved in this process, and we need to send reasonable, fair-minded legislators to Austin. So that will help make my job easier for LGRL up here in Austin, and it will make it easier for us back in the districts. We need to focus, you know, in the long term and the short term. Tomorrow, you know, if people want to call, they can call and voice their opposition to HB 1911 by calling Mr. Talton's office if they so choose. Or they can get all that information off our website at lgrl.org. And just become involved in the process. Tomorrow, the next bill that's up, and throughout the year in the interim. Making sure that we elect fair-minded legislators.
Great. Well, Randall, we really appreciate you talking to us, and you'll be updating us every week throughout the end of the session. And also, there's a major fundraiser for LGRL on the 8th of May?
It's on the 4th of May.
4th of May, okay. And that's up in Austin. It's the largest Pride Festival in...
We're confusing fundraisers.
Are we? Okay.
There's the 8th of June, we do. The Texas Pride Festival up here in June. And that is a great opportunity for people to come out and show their Texas gay pride and help support LGRL in our mission.
Okay, great. Well, we'll talk to you again next week. And the best way to get information on LGRL, as you said, is go to the website lgrl.org.
Exactly. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Randall. And now let's listen to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 19th, 2003. 14 more Egyptian men this week were given prison sentences ranging from 1 to 3 years on debauchery charges for homosexuality. One man's phone was bugged for more than a month after someone tipped off police, and the resulting evidence was used against the other 13 defendants. Two more men were found not guilty, and some of the convicted men may appeal. Egypt's crackdown on gays has already resulted in dozens of convictions and possibly hundreds of arrests over the last 2 years, sparking extensive international protest.
The current sentencing came within a week of a European Parliament resolution calling for an immediate end to the persecution and enactment of civil rights protections for gays and lesbians. This week, Egypt's Speaker of the Parliament, Ahmed Fatih Sarour, responded with an open letter to the EP that was distributed by Egypt's official news agency, MENA. He accused the EP of trying to interfere in Egypt's internal affairs, calling the resolution an arbitrary judgment that oversimplified dangerous issues. He cast the issue as one of respect for the people's choice of their legal system and protection of their religious and cultural values. He noted that Egypt's penal code does not include punitive measures against homosexuals, as the country's law by no means interferes in the private affairs of individuals, but only publicly practicing acts that demonstrate a degradation of religions and instigate for licentiousness. While that may technically be true, Egyptian authorities have gone far beyond police and public behavior in their pursuit of gays, engaging not only in wiretapping but in internet sting operations. One such sting resulted in a 15-month prison sentence for Wasim Taufik Abiad, who has been adopted as a prisoner of conscience by UK-based human rights watchdog Amnesty International.
Britain's Labour government this week revised its proposed legislation against public sex. The Parliament is currently considering the government's sexual offences bill, a sweeping update of the criminal code that includes elimination of gay-specific charges, gross indecency, buggery, and solicitation by men. But it also included a proposed ban on sexual activity in a public place, intended primarily to stop sex between men in public toilets. Police told ministers last week it would be difficult to enforce in the face of widely published but misleading claims that suspects could escape conviction simply by closing a stall door. Ministers announced this week that they're dropping the public sex proposal and instead will amend the long-standing common law offense of outraging public decency. That reliance on old law raised concerns for Britain's gay and lesbian advocacy group Stonewall, whose director for parliamentary affairs, Sasha Deshmukh, told Gay.com, "The government need to be clear that the law against outraging public decency, which was written in Victorian times, won't be used in a way that targets or discriminates against the gay community." Meanwhile, Stonewall is lobbying in support of a bill introduced by the Liberal Democrats to add homophobic bias crimes to Britain's hate crimes law, which the House of Commons will debate in late May.
The admitted assassin of Pim Fortuyn, the Netherlands politician who might well have become the world's first openly gay prime minister, was sentenced this week to 18 years in prison for the murder. Volkert van de Graaf is likely to actually serve only 11. Most had expected a life sentence, although that's rare in the Netherlands and usually given only to serial killers. But the judge panel said van de Graaf was unlikely to repeat his crime and should have a chance to reintegrate in society. Fortuyn's supporters reacted to the sentence with rage and tears. Someone later enclosed bullets with a letter threatening death to the presiding judge and the prosecutor. The Amsterdam public prosecutor will appeal the sentence, declaring the judges had not adequately considered van de Graaf's intention to seriously thwart the democratic process or his lack of remorse. In a final statement to the court, van de Graaf did say he regretted the grief he had caused, but repeated his belief that, like Hitler, Fortuyn's rise to power would have caused suffering to Muslims and other marginalized groups. Fortuyn was shot shortly before national elections last year. On the May 6th anniversary of his death, a statue of him will be erected in Rotterdam, his birthplace.
The death of a New York gay man by alleged medical negligence has led to what's believed to be the first recognition of a Vermont civil union as conferring spousal status by a court in another U.S. state. The late Neil Spice Handler died of heart disease at St. Vincent's Manhattan Hospital more than a year ago, 3 days after suffering leg injuries from a hit-and-run driver. He contracted a civil union with John Langan shortly after the pioneering Vermont partnership law went into effect in 2000. Langan is suing the hospital with the help of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. This week, Nassau County State Justice John Dunn rejected the hospital's argument that Langan lacked legal standing to file a wrongful death lawsuit. He emphasized that his ruling applied only to wrongful death filings, not to other purposes. But he wrote that it is impossible to justify, under equal protection principles, withholding the same recognition from a union which meets all the requirements of a marriage in New York, but for the sexual orientation of its partners. He noted that state law does not specifically define spouses as being of different sexes.
But the Texas State Senate this week approved by a more than 3-to-1 margin a bill to specifically prevent legal recognition of other U.S. states' gay and lesbian civil unions or marriages. Same-gender marriages are not currently legal in any state, and Texas is one of many that already explicitly refuse to perform them. Only Vermont currently offers civil unions, although similar proposals are in process in 5 other states. Republican State Senator for San Antonio Jeff Wentworth's bill, which in the Senate was opposed solely by Democrats, moves next to the state house. It includes provision for some insurance and property rights for same-gender partners, in its words, without the existence of any legally recognized familial relationship.
Same-gender couples lost in 2 other U.S. legislative actions last week. Connecticut's Senate Judiciary Committee, by more than 60%, rejected a bill to establish registered domestic partnerships for gay and lesbian couples carrying many of the legal benefits of marriage. That could well mean the end of the controversial bill for this session, but supporters have vowed to bring it back.
And commissioners of the Port of Seattle, Washington, last week voted 3-to-1 against developing an equal benefits ordinance like the city of Seattle's. That ordinance requires the city's contractors to extend the same benefits to their unmarried employees' domestic partners as they do to their legally married workers' spouses.
Even in Canada, there seem to be limits as to how far the legal notion of family can be stretched. Last week, a judge in London, Ontario, rejected a lesbian's bid to be recognized as a parent to her partner's son because the boy already has 2 legal parents, his biological mother and father. All 3 share the parenting, and Family Court Justice David Aston wrote that the child is a bright, healthy, happy individual who is obviously thriving in a loving family that meets his every need. I'm prepared to make the declaration sought if there is jurisdiction to do so. But he went on to rule that current law denies him the power to confer parental status on more than 2 people. He wrote, "If a child can have 3 parents, why not 4 or 6 or a dozen? What about all the adults in a commune or a religious organization or a sect?" Well, some might say it takes a village to raise a child. The case drew national attention. 4 religious right groups had sought intervener status in the case to oppose the parents. Their motion was denied since the decision went their way, but they could get their chance if the parents decide to appeal.
But back in the U.S., there was a legal victory last week for members of the Gay-Straight Alliance at Boyd County High School in Kentucky. A long-running controversy over the GSA in this conservative area climaxed in December when the county school board voted to suspend meetings of all non-curricular clubs, even though the local school council supported the GSA. Seven GSA members responded with a federal lawsuit with the help of the American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky. That was an act of bravery in the face of threats and harassment against the group. In fact, the county school board claimed that it had to stop the GSA to prevent violence and disruption, and admitted it wasn't GSA members who created those problems. As has happened in previous cases in other states, U.S. District Judge David Bunning said that the Federal Equal Access Act gives the GSA the same rights as other campus groups. He noted that despite the supposed ban on club meetings, some had in fact continued, including the Bible Club. The case is far from over, but Bunning issued an injunction requiring the GSA be allowed to meet, and he expected that as a result, the ban on other clubs meeting would soon be lifted.
And finally, Jews around the world celebrated Passover this week, but some updated its traditional opening dinner ceremony, the Seder. A group of women at New Orleans Tulane University used a feminist liturgy that makes the Israelites' escape from slavery in Egypt a metaphor for breaking free of sexual stereotyping and prejudice today. Added to the ritual, food items on their Seder plate was one to represent marginalized groups, especially women, gay men, and lesbians. An orange.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 19th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinger.
And I brought a special song tonight. I've been looking for a while for an anti-war song by a gay and lesbian artist, and I found one. And it talks about oil and the right wing and losing our civil liberties. It just wraps it all up. The artist happens to be somebody I've met. Her name is Ellis. She's out of Minneapolis. It's from her new album, which is called Tigers Above, Tigers Below. The song is called Freedom.
What is this war we're fighting? So many people will be dying. Innocent lives, the price of oil, and the old white men in the old white house are gonna turn everything inside out. They say it's protection for you. Freedom, we will protect you, lock you up tight, so no one will get you. Oh, how precious you are. You won't mind being locked up, dear freedom, just for a while, just till we beat them all elusive enemies.
And as J.D. pointed out before we started playing the song, the name of that was Freedom by a female artist named Ellis from an album Tigers Above, Tigers Below. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Well, I wish it was happier times, Sally. Sally Huffer's here with the from the Montrose Counseling Center. Music slip up there, you know. Sometimes our machines do wild things.
I thought that was my special intro. Yes, Sally, tell us a little bit about what kind of a last couple weeks you've had.
Things have been a little frantic in the fundraising arena. We found out that we've lost some of our money that we were counting on from United Way. They've decided to cut some of the money that they were giving to our programs. Specifically, they decided that they were going to defund our HIV counseling program, and so we don't get any money for that from United Way. And they also decided that, and before I go on, I should mention that their annual campaign was down this year.
About how much?
From, according to an article that I read in the Chronicle, about 13%.
Okay.
So we do know, you know, we're not the only one that's experiencing these cuts. But one of the other programs that we're feeling much more of an impact is our LIFE program, which is a basic psychotherapy program where people come and talk about anything from coming out issues, relationship issues. I mean, it is the heart of Montrose Counseling Center, our LIFE program. And one of the problems we have with losing that money is that the LIFE program doesn't receive funding from any other government sources, whereas the HIV counseling program still does. And so... so things are a little bit tight there. They also cut funding to our anti-violence program by 6%. And so we're feeling that impact. And shortly thereafter, we found out that we're not going to be getting the funding that we had hoped to get from the governor's office and the Victims of Crime Act. And that's $150,000 that that we've lost. So things are a little difficult right now. We're having to go to local foundations and corporations. And in addition to the money that we had budgeted that we needed to ask for to make up the what we didn't have in these programs, we're still having to ask them to make up money that we had hoped to get either from United Way or VOCA.
Are you also seeing an increase of people needing services?
It's been a steady increase year after year. And as I say, our LIFE program is the heart of the counseling programs at Montrose Counseling Center, and it year after year has far more clients in that program than any of the others.
So do you anticipate, you know, maybe you don't can't even say this, but any staff cuts?
We've been told that we don't anticipate any staff cuts in, for example, the anti-violence program, which has sexual assault, domestic partner violence, as well as our bias and hate crimes. Some of those clients, you know, we anticipate keeping the same counselors. We're going to try to shift them into other counseling programs that we have. We're going to see if they qualify for other grants, because in the past, anybody that entered our anti-violence program didn't have to pay anything. So we might have to shift it to a sliding scale. We might have to, you know, check and see if people are eligible through insurance and so forth. But we don't anticipate having any staff reductions, and we don't anticipate it that it would impact the clients, you know, greatly.
Right. So you're trying to provide all these services, and money's being cut, and you're all trying to figure out how you can shuffle some of the funding around, if at all possible.
Exactly.
So it must be pretty hectic over there.
Well, and I know that we're not the only ones.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, we are up for the same dollars as many nonprofits, and the economy being what it is, I mean, so many of these, particularly local endowments and so forth, a lot of their money is tied up in the stock market. And if the stock market isn't doing well, then the endowment doesn't have as much money to give to different agencies. And when we're all competing for the same dollars, which we are, sometimes the GLBT organizations get kind of put down on the priority list.
Right, but we're all going to get these great tax cuts so that we won't, right.
Well, I guess my next question, though, is I wanted to talk about this. You will not deny clients services, will you?
No, we won't. In fact, we can't. If somebody's in crisis and they present themselves for service, or if they're already in our program, we can't legally or ethically stop giving them services. And that's one of the issues that we have, even with, for example, some of the government funding that we have already that isn't being cut in the HIV counseling program, there's only so many sessions that a client can have under those programs. Now, once they come to the end of that term, and especially now that people with HIV disease are living longer, that the need to stretch those appointments out is getting greater and greater. And so so that's what, you know, one of the things is we do an assessment at that time. If they're in crisis, and it's not even the legal part, it's the ethically part. You know, we want to make sure that the people get the services that they need.
And talk a little bit about the services you provide. Do you get the sense that some people feel like because you're providing mental and emotional counseling, that maybe your services aren't as quote-unquote important as those who are actually providing medication and physical therapy?
Well, see, there's the rub. We've got, you know, the so-called stigma of being a mental health organization and a GLBT organization. So, I think that a lot of times a lot of funders in particular, especially a lot of the drug companies, are going to fund a lot of the organizations that do treat diseases, and they treat, you know, specific, you know, and we have, you know, outcomes of that we can actually measure how somebody has progressed through the counseling program. But it's not as quantifiable as the information that you can get from drug treatment and how well that's going.
But we all know, I mean, we all know from experience, if it was all about just taking a pill, you know, then that would be great. But there's so many other issues you have to deal with beyond just getting yourself medicated.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I've been around the community for a while, and I know that a lot of times people think, oh, the counseling center is this enormous organization, and that it has a large budget, which we do, and they think that, you know, we're not in need of community support, or that we're not in need of the funds. But in actuality, we are. We provide so many services. I mean, if the need weren't there, we wouldn't be as large as we are. Mm-hmm. And so so at this point, we are turning and looking to the community and saying, hey, we need your support now. We need you to know that we're here and that we're struggling, and we want to keep these services available.
Well, how much of the money does come from donations from the community? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I don't know the percentages, and I probably should have checked that in advance. I know that, for example, in the LIFE program this last year, that outside of money that we get from United Way, that we needed to make up $95,000 in mm-hmm. order to meet the rest of the budget. And so so on top of now looking to get the money that we're not getting from United Way, which is about $30,000, we have to add that to the amount that we normally seek from local foundations.
And right, and you're also now the switchboard. And Hatch is also part of your organization.
Right. And one of the things that we had decided when Hatch came on board was that for a lot of the events like Crew of Olympus or Bunnies on the Bayou, those kind of events that Hatch had normally gone for funding dollars, and the Counseling Center had too, that we decided that we wanted to commit those dollars if we should be lucky enough to be chosen as a beneficiary. We still want that to go to Hatch. We think it's very important that the people in this particular community recognize the leaders of the future and recognize the youth that are here and that are going through the issues that they face. And so we have made a commitment that for those organizations, we're still going to go, we're still going to look for money for Hatch.
And speaking of that, yesterday was the bunny party, and it was a wonderful event, even though there was a little bit of rain. And
glad to hear it. I mean, not that it rained, but glad that it was a good event.
Yeah, well, and
get a big crowd.
It was. I understand there was 1,800 people, which is lower than normal. But considering that it was raining and cloudy and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you
had
that bad storm first thing in the morning.
Not here, though. Not in the center part of town. It didn't happen.
God won't let it rain on the big party.
Well, or the parade. But, you know, that's the interesting thing is the bunny party, they raise their money to put on the event, and all the money that's collected the day of the event goes to community organizations.
Right. And so, you know, we are still trying to pitch Hatch as the beneficiary of most of those. If they had gone for it before, we don't want to have to set up any kind of conflict. So
where do we go? I mean, there's just the hope of everything is going to work out, and you're all going to have to work pretty hard in trying to get community money involved and go after other grants.
There is that, and it's primarily looking for more grants, grants that we haven't applied for in the past, and just, you know, hunkering down and trying to do that. We have always prided ourselves at the Counseling Center that you know, 98% of our budget goes directly to client services. That's pretty amazing.
Yes,
yeah, that
absolutely.
Is.
I mean,
that is.
I can tell you in my own office that because I know where the money's coming in and so forth, that I'm recycling paper. If I get something in the mail with a paper clip, I snag that paper clip and I think, you know, I mean, I know it's just, you know, a fraction of a penny, I'm sure, but I recognize that anything that I use in my office or anything that I do is coming from money that people are donating on behalf of our clients. And so 98% of your income for a nonprofit going directly to client service is a very, very high percentage. And we're still very proud of that. We, you know, have always operated a very lean budget. And, you know, we anticipate, you know, that we're going to have to figure out more ways to stretch it.
Okay, so none of y'all are in it for the money, huh?
I don't think anybody in nonprofit... And I don't think anybody at KPFT is here for the money either.
We're trying to find the money, as we're all volunteers. Well, hopefully things will work out. And I know you all work very hard in making that happen. And it's just amazing that, you know, they talk about these tax cuts nationally. And every, you know, as we were talking earlier, you know, it's like every state, almost every state, not almost every state.
How about the money we're sending to, you know, to rebuild Iraq?
Well, we're not really building it. We're just getting the oil wells up.
I know. But, hey, we're sending money over there.
So, but anyway, Sally, thank you very much. Sally Huffer with the Montrose Counseling Center. Thank you for joining us this evening. And
thank you. Do you mind if I mention something else on the air?
Go for it.
Just real quick. I just wanted, as far as Hatch is concerned, this coming Saturday, the 26th at 7 o'clock, the youth have been working on a program with HISD called Writers in the Schools, and they are going to be giving a presentation again this Saturday, the 26th at 7 o'clock at Holocaust Museum, and it's going to be about poetry that they've written about tolerance. And so it's in conjunction with the Holocaust Museum Houston as well as the Freed Library here in Montrose. And so I just wanted to, we haven't had a chance to get that information out to anybody.
Okay.
So I just wanted to take a second
great.
And be sure to
That's
mention
excellent.
That. So it would be great for people to come out and see the writing that these incredibly talented youth are doing.
And if you want any more information on the Montrose Counseling Center, it's montrosecounselingcenter.org.
montrosecounselingcenter.org or 713-529-0037. And if you ask for me and you want to give us a donation, I will be happy to give you the information.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Contributors to the new anthology, Queer Jews, would probably be among the first to say that being Jewish can be a mixed blessing for lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgenders. This Way Out's Josie Katogio chats with co-editor Karen Aviv, who says that her book with David Schneer allows a new generation of voices to explore this complicated subject.
This is a very fascinating anthology. As a lesbian feminist, I've been familiar with ones that came out in the 70s and 80s, like Nice Jewish Girls. Why is this sort of the new version, and why did it need to be done?
Well, I think it's new and different in that it includes the voices of bisexual and transgender people, and those voices haven't been heard in previous anthologies. And also, it unapologetically embraces the word queer, which I think is a much more inclusive term that can include allies and straight people who sort of identify as queer, bisexual people, transgendered folk, people who weren't necessarily included in those previous anthologies that were very important for a lot of people's coming out experiences.
Let's talk a little bit about what's changed within Judaism, because mm-hmm. Judaism was one of the first religions to really, at least the liberal Jews, to come forward and do weddings and ceremonies and include gay people in their congregations.
Right. I think, you know, it's a claim that we make in our book, and I sort of half believe it. So, you know, I think there are certain segments of American Judaism, particularly Reform and Reconstructionist and Renewal movements, that the majority of American Jews actually belong to those movements. Those are much more progressive than, say, conservative Judaism, which does not allow openly gay or lesbian or bisexual transgender people to become ordained rabbis, and certainly Orthodoxy, which is on the most sort of furthest to the right politically in terms of queer issues. So there's a lot of diversity within American Jewish communities on the issue of queer identity and being out. And I think that there are a lot of changes actually taking place in all of those communities. What I find so interesting is that there's this tension that runs throughout the book of are we adopting mainstream situations and institutions and kind of family arrangements at our own expense? Or is there something creative and vital and new about what we're doing by wanting to get married and wanting to have children? I think it depends on who you ask. There's one essay by Rabbi Jane Littman, who identifies as bisexual and is a rabbi in Berkeley. And for her, making meaning out of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, Jewish weddings, for her is like the highest form of spirituality, because she is helping people reclaim their Jewish heritage and reinvent a tradition that has historically oppressed queers or excluded them, certainly. And she likens it to sitting in at a lunch counter during the civil rights struggles of the 1960s, which I think is a really powerful metaphor.
A lot of people raise the whole issue of how binary the gender situation is within Judaism.
Yeah.
How important it is to identify as either male or female. And there's a really, really touching piece in here that I found fascinating by two transgendered people, one of whom is a former sort of lesbian separatist butch activist who is transitioning into a male identity. And when she goes to Israel and you have to, you know, go to one side of the wall or the other, but depending on whether you're male or female, and literally the gender police read her as male and send her to the male side, and she's kind of really torn about whether that's where she needs to be or not.
Well, first I just want to say that I'm really, really honored and proud to have TJ and Allie and also Jaron Kenigson, another transgender Jew, participate in this anthology, because they are, to my knowledge, the first transgender Jewish voices that have ever been published. And in terms of TJ and Allie's piece, Allie Cannon and TJ Michaels talked about their very divergent experiences at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And Allie really experienced it as a rite of passage, because he passed on the men's side and saw it as an affirmation of his emerging transgender male identity. And TJ, on the other hand, you know, was booted out of the women's side by the gender police, who literally, you know, just told her that she didn't belong there. And when she went onto the men's side, experienced this real existential crisis of, where do I belong? You know, am I betraying my sisters who are on the other side of the gender partition, and where is my place in Judaism and in my body? So they really highlight what Judaism depends on in a way for making meaning, and how Judaism has really defined people by these very rigid gender categories. Now, having said that, I just want to put it out there that in Israel, the Orthodox rabbinate maintains total control over family law and the regulation of public space at religious sites. And therefore, you know, the gender police are in action all the time. That's not the case in the United States, where Judaism, I think, is much more pluralistic and much more flexible. And in some religious denominations and congregations, it's far more egalitarian. So there is space for women to take on very public, very active roles in their communities within American Judaism, and that's not the case in Israel. You know, it's very, very complicated. Our book more focuses on the North American Jewish kind of queer diaspora, and there's one essay in the book by Ruti Kadish, which is really focusing on Israeli gay men and lesbian women's experiences of Israeli kind of Zionist discourse, and what their relationship is to that discourse and how it informs their masculinity and femininity. And what she argues is that for Israeli men, coming out and also serving in the army is seen as like a betrayal to the Zionist cause, which depends on this idea of heterosexual kind of strong and virile masculinity. And for Israeli lesbians, the idea of reproduction and motherhood is so salient for all Israeli women, regardless of sexual orientation, that a lot of Israeli lesbians feel this pressure to have children. And when they don't, or if they don't, they are penalized socially. So the ironic twist to all of this is that a lot of Israeli lesbians are having children through artificial insemination that is paid for by the state, believe it or not, because the state wants to see as many Jewish children in the state of Israel as possible. So Israeli lesbians are taking advantage of that and getting pregnant and having the state pay for all this cost. Whereas in the United States, you can't get anybody to pay you to have a child. So, and it's a weird kind of twist of events. And also wanted to mention that unlike in the United States, Israel has a lot of legal and civil rights, like domestic partnerships and the ability, like it or not, to serve in the military that we lack in terms of basic civil rights here in the United States. So it's a mixed bag of whether or not it's a better place to be out and queer and Jewish in Israel or in the United States.
Well, for me, it's more the issue of how safe is it to criticize mm-hmm. Israel when you feel loyalty as a Jew, but yet you want to criticize the political policies.
Right. And I think that there are a lot of people, a lot of queer Jews and a lot of non-queer progressive Jews who feel a lot of anguish about this issue and, you know, have deep emotional connections and attachments to Israel and also are deeply anguished about what's happening there and about the government's policies. Having said that, I also know plenty of queer Jews who are kind of on the right in terms of Israeli politics. So there is no consensus. It's actually a very interesting conversation that I am privy to at the moment.
Well, there's a lot of really fascinating pieces in your book, Queer Jews. It seems to me that many of the pieces in this book mm-hmm. would be of interest to anybody because they're talking about love and conflict and identity mm-hmm. and, you know, many issues that are vital to all of us.
Absolutely. One of the questions that we've gotten, that David and I have gotten on our roadshow with this book is, you know, who is this intended for? Who do you want to read this book? And my answer is always, you know, anybody. We want, you know, queers and straight people and allies and parents of gays and lesbians and bisexual transgender folk. We want educators to read this, especially in the Jewish community, policymakers, anybody who has an interest in expanding their understanding of what it means to be human, really. And just to add a wrinkle to that argument, David Schneer, my co-editor, wrote an essay about queering a Jewish school and teaching as like the principal of Congregation Shaar Zahav in San Francisco, where we met. And his experience was very ironic because this is a queer school, so what does a queer Jewish education look like? There's that set of questions, which have some pretty fascinating answers. And then his other sort of exploration was, what does it mean to be a queer Jewish school where half of the parents are actually straight and are deliberately sending their kids to this school because they want their children to learn about Judaism from a very progressive, pluralistic, and queer-friendly perspective. Straight people are coming to us because they see our communities as somehow more diverse and pluralistic and tolerant and better places to raise their children. And I'm very blessed and grateful to be alive right now because the past 30 years have just seen a tidal wave of change in all of these different arenas, and it's great.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
I've been talking with Karen Aviv, who is co-editor with David Schneer of the book Queer Jews, published by Routledge. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'm Josie Kitogio.
Life's not worth a damn till you can say
I am what I am.
I am what I am. Soy lo que soy.
I am what I am.
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 We are what we are. Listen to After Hours, Queer Radio with Attitude, every late, late Saturday nights, 1 a.m. to Sunday, 4 a.m., only on KPFT Houston.
Ooh, I am what I am.
This is Queer Voices.
To hold his hand on the street, on a date, simple dream. Doesn't seem like special ride. exchanging wedding vows. This sacred institution, his next of kin, acknowledged by the state. Don't be scared, we're prepared to handle special rights. Special means distinctive, unique, or uncommon. How uncommon can they be when the vast majority have them granted? Take them for granted. As for the IRS, I want to file jointly with the man I love. So why am I denied special rights? They're not quite so special. I am wise to the fact that special rights are really equal rights in disguise. But not to say, with this ring and have that bring a world of privileges and great responsibilities of married life, acknowledged by the state, special rights. I guess they are quite special. I'm in line when the day comes that special rights meaning equal rights are
predicting the future of darkness too.
There's no denying many have died.
Lives have been lost, tears have been cried.
And there's so much pain and so little relief that it's hard to feel hope in a moment of grief.
But if that's what it takes to help someone live, then we have a lot we can give.
Because there's no such thing as false hope. There's no dream that isn't real. No such thing as false hope. No one can say what the future will reveal. If we believe in our hearts that it's true, surely our hope will pull us through. Listen into the TV scare. It only weakens you with despair. They paint a portrait full of doubt by leaving the long-term survivors out.
And as a result, how many are gone? Because their hope was denied for too long. And if that's what it takes to help someone live, then we have a lot we can give.
Because there's no such thing as false hope. There's no dream that isn't real. No such thing as false hope. No one can say what the future will reveal. If we believe in our hearts that it's true, surely our hope will pull us through.
Hope is on
Thank you.